This uncertain landscape has inspired our conversation to get to the other side. Sure, we want to get there, but can we move in a way that's woven deeply with ourselves, each other, and the deepest threads of the fabric of existence? In this episode, we sit with our friend Justin Lay, who helps us consider the kind of resilience that might be required to get to the other side.
Let me tell you a story about tiny Justin. My parents got divorced when I was 2. My dad left, and I grew up pretty poor and without a dad. But in a lot of ways, I was one of the lucky ones. When my dad left, we lived in Florida. So my mom is in Florida by herself with 3 kids. And she finds her way back to Ohio, where we can move in with my grandparents. So at least now, we have a place to live. But my mom still had no job and no money. But here's the thing. My mom knew how to get things done. When she had to put food on the table, she got the help she needed from food stamps and community pantries. When we needed health care, she made sure we got on Medicaid. In addition to working full-time, eventually, and being a single mom to 3 kids, she worked another full-time just getting us the basics we needed to live, from community organizations and government support. She got it done. But in a lot of ways, she's one of the lucky ones. My mom had a number of advantages. She's white. She had people in her life who cared about her. She wasn't seriously mentally ill. She didn't suffer from addiction. You can imagine that this story could have been a lot worse. You see, my mom has a thing many of us refer to as resilience. You would think that with all this stuff happening, she would just give up. People give up all the time, but she didn't. And that is resilience. Maybe some of you have stories like this about yourselves. Maybe some of you are living a story like this right now. And getting to the other side of a story like this takes resilience. In some ways, that's a throwaway line, right? Resilience. Of course it takes resilience to get through something difficult. But what does that really mean? Why was my mom able to get to the other side of that hard spot in her life? Why was I able to grow up and be successful, whatever that means, but a successful contributing member of society, when lots of people in my situation have not emerged in the same way? This is not to pat myself on the back. Of course, there were some obvious advantages. I'm white. I'm a man. I'm not battling severe mental illness. And probably dozens of other privileges I'm not even aware of. If anything, I just chalk it up to luck and randomness of chance, rather than my own talent or skill. But I also think I am resilient. I'm Justin Lay. And in this podcast, I'm going to talk about how the balance of our internal resilience and the physical circumstances around us work together to help us get to the other side of difficult times. I'm going to take some things from a business I've started with a few other smart people called Rima Health. I've spent most of my career building software that helps people be healthier. So when I look at a problem like the broken way we treat poor people in America, I look at it through the lens of technology and health. When I think about how to get to the other side of a pandemic and economic downturn, naturally I think I should quit my job that currently supports my family and start a business to solve this problem. Naturally, right? Well, here I am. What is Rima Health, you might ask? Rima uses emerging technology like artificial intelligence and machine learning, along with passionate and empathetic humans, to build resilience with vulnerable and complex Medicaid members. We do this by helping these members solve some of their day-to-day challenges with housing, mental illness, addiction. And along the way, we help them build the resilience they need to improve their life. So, let's dig into this resilience thing. Let's start with, what is it? I'm not going to give you a simple Webster's definition, because that does a disservice to just how complex resilience actually is. Instead, I'm going to have some other smart people talk about it as we go on this journey together and figure it out. Let me start by introducing you to a guy named Shaka Sengor. Shaka Sengor shot and killed a man in 1991, after which he spent 19 years in a variety of Michigan prisons. 7 of those 19 years were in solitary confinement, which is really just a room all by himself with no contact with the outside world. This is considered a form of torture by many experts. 4.5 of those 7 years were consecutive. So for 4.5 years, Sengor had no contact with anyone and lived alone in a very small room. Since being released from prison in 2010, he's become an advocate, lecturer, writer, on a host of issues, but let's hear what Shaka Sengor has to say about resilience.
Human beings, I believe, by nature, are very resilient. And oftentimes, we don't recognize our own resiliency until we're faced with obstacles and circumstances that challenge us and pushes us. And it looks different for everybody. You know, when I think about my journey through in prison, you know, I went through some very adverse experiences. I had some significant obstacles to overcome, including, you know, long-term solitary confinement, which they estimate is designed to drive a person crazy after 90 days. And what I found in that environment is that people figure out ways to cope and to survive and to get through when they're forced to do so. And for me, I found that I was very resourceful when my back was against the wall, and that resilience was also a choice. You know, I had a choice in whether to give up. I had a choice in whether to fight for a second chance. And, you know, that type of resilience was inspired by other people. You know, I read Nelson Mandela's autobiography. You know, I read the poem Invictus. I read, you know, Malcolm X's autobiography. And I love autobiographies. But what I learned through reading is that if you acknowledge what you're going through and you recognize that it is an obstacle and that it's that dark moment, but you also realize there's light on the other side of that tunnel, then you can get through. And to me, I think hope is probably the cornerstone of resilience. As long as you have hope, you can come out on the other side of anything. Once you dim the light of hope, there's no possibility of you coming out on the other side. And to me, I think that's what resiliency is. You know, I always looked at, if I focus on the purpose instead of the pain, then I can get through to the other side. And that's how I live my life. And to me, you know, those things embody what resilience really is. 3 of the ingredients toward being resilient is you have to be optimistic. Optimism is such an integral part of getting through adversity. I would say a second thing is really being resourceful and figuring out in your environment what are things people inspiring, you know, components that you can utilize to help you cope with whatever it is you're going through. And then I think the third thing would be, you have to have memory loss. I know that probably sounds crazy, right? But what I found is that a lot of times we replay memories that no longer exist over and over in our head. And what that does is it holds you hostage. And so once you begin to release those memories and recognize that you can never reclaim that space or that time, or that experience, then you can move forward in life. You know, because now you've taken the shackles off your feet and you're a lot more mobile. And I think in order to be resilient, you have to not be thinking about what happened in the past. And you really just have to be focused on what you need to do to move forward.
Hope, optimism, resourcefulness, memory loss, those are good. We'll come back to our friend Shaka in a few minutes after I talk about me some more. If you ask anyone who knows me well, especially my family, they will tell you that I love to bake. I love to eat baked goods, of course, but I also like to bake things that other people like to eat. When I do, people often tell me how delicious the things are that I bake. When I hear this, in my head, I can't help but think, I just followed the recipe, put in the right ingredients, and this delicious thing came out. Is that how resilience works? Can we really just do these three things, and out comes resilience? Is it really just about not giving up? I don't think that's what Senghor is saying. And if we had a chance for dialogue with him, or maybe even more than a three-minute video, I think we'd get into some much deeper nuance. But even just taking his three points at face value makes a lot of sense to me. These are things that would make anyone going through a difficult time more resilient. But let's talk about some nuance. One of the best things about fabric for me is that many of our conversations force me to consider gray and ambiguous stuff. Perhaps you all remember Greg Meyer, our fearless leader, putting a wobbly board between two milk crates and then walking between the crates on the board and almost falling when he's in the middle, but feeling very sturdy when he stands closer to the ends of the board that are firmly on top of the crate. He does this to illustrate how it can be uncomfortable to consider multiple points of view at the same time, like standing in the middle of that board, instead of just sticking with what we already know and are comfortable with, like the ends of the board firmly on top of the milk crate. With that analogy in mind, let's look at another perspective on resilience. This is from a guy named Dr. Michael Unger. Unger is a researcher in the field of social and psychological resilience, and is principal investigator for the Resilience Research Center at a university in Canada. See if you can find the difference between what Senghor and Unger think about resilience.
Let me give you a completely different example. Take you outside of Canada for a moment. Take you to northern Japan, if I could. You're, of course, familiar with the earthquake that then caused a tsunami, and then afterwards, of course, the nuclear disaster in northern Japan. I'm working with some colleagues over there, principally a fellow named Keiji Akiyama, and he's been trying to understand the trauma caused by those events on children in northern Japan. And I went up with him at one point. We were over there and just trying to get a sense of the research and what he was up to and trying to support him as best we could. What you may not know is that actually more children survived than adults. And the reason for that was that the schools were inland a little ways. And the schools, this happened at noon on a school day. And the children were evacuated up when the tsunami alarms went off. They evacuated the children, as was protocol. In other words, good social policy saved the children. The parents who were down in the floodplain and in the factories, of course, didn't experience quite the same fate. What was interesting was, and I want to make this a little more complicated because I'm talking about the differential impact. So how do you resolve trauma in a situation like that? How do we facilitate resilience in this particular population of kids? And what I saw the Japanese do is, one, they managed to get people resettled. This was remarkable. They managed to get their kids back to school within 3 weeks. Do you know how long people were out of school in High River, Alberta? Like months and months. Do you know how long they were out of school down in post-Katrina? Months and months. Now, you think about all the things I've said make us resilient. Connections, continuity, structure, consequences, attachment, being treated fairly, and everything else. The Japanese, they had that capacity within their culture to immediately respond, get kids rehoused, try and keep them in their same school districts with their same peer groups. There was a real emphasis on continuity of attachments and engagement. All the NGOs came in and basically set up these after-school schools for these kids to attend. Now, this is really culturally specific. If you're a Japanese child, your day is basically you go to school all day, go home, get a snack, and then you go back to school all evening and on weekends. Because part of your job is to get to university. So I often hear people say, well, you know, we should instill hopefulness in children to be more robust. You don't tell a child to be hopeful. You give them an experience that makes them normal again. These children actually wanted to, well, they wanted to get out of their small little temporary houses with their parents as well, or whoever was surviving and they were living with. But they would come to these places, and this gave them a program, a structure, a sense of direction in life. It gave them the relational spaces that they were looking for. After about three of these, I get it, Kenji, I get it. But what about like the psychology programs, and what about the right to play, soccer clubs? What about the sports field? All the things that we would do in Canada for the kids, right? And he looked at me, you know you're having a cultural moment, when my colleague looks at me and goes, Mike, why would we want our children wasting time playing?
How do you facilitate resilience? You don't tell someone to be hopeful. You give them an experience that makes them feel normal again. Now that we are over 4 months into a pandemic that has dramatically changed the way we live our lives, I'm sure you've all noticed that anytime you get to go out and do a quote-unquote normal pre-quarantine activity, it feels amazing. I'm guessing it feels better than someone simply telling you to be hopeful. Maybe you're starting to see a different perspective between Michael Unger and Shaka Sengor. Sengor says, be optimistic, be resourceful. Forget the bad stuff that might be holding you hostage. Unger says, if we want someone to be resilient, we have to change the physical circumstances around them so that they can be more hopeful. In other words, if we want Sengor to be hopeful while he's in prison, we have to take him out of the dark, lonely hole he was being forced to live in so that he can imagine a different future for himself. But he didn't have that, and yet he was still hopeful. Let's listen to another story from Unger.
I worked with there was a boy, he's very, about 10 years old, very awkward. He'd been raised in dire poverty. His teeth were awful. He had hand-me-down clothing, and it was like, you know, he had a big target on him in the school that said, pick on me, sort of thing, or that type of thing. And though the school had done what they could to try and keep him safe, this kid hated going to school. So what he had done was he had adapted and found his own pattern of resilience by hiding with the janitor at lunch breaks and at the recess breaks. Rather than going out on the playground where he didn't feel safe, he would hang out with the janitor. And the janitor was this gruff old guy, like just salt of the earth, down to earth, kind of guy, right? That would sweep the floors and mop the floors. He was really good with the kids. He was just kind of honest. On the weekends, he'd go out hunting moose or whatever. This is in the Maritimes, right? So, you know, very sort of, just sort of easily to access kind of guy. The kid loved being in his shadow. So the kid, I suppose he hung out by this guy for like a week or so to protect himself, right? His adaptation, his pathway, his navigation to the resources he needed. About after a week, the janitor looks at this kid and goes, and he had a bit of a sort of a Newfoundland brogue or whatever, so I can't quite do it. But he kind of says to the kid, well, bloody hell, if you're always going to be underfoot, you might as well pick up a mop and give me a hand. Now, I don't know about occupational health and safety laws and stuff like that. I'm sure he just broke every single one, right, by having the kid help. But basically, the kid picks up the mop and begins to sort of mop the floor with the janitor on the breaks. Now, a whole bunch of things magically happen in that case. The child begins to feel a genuine connection and contribution to the welfare of this adult. He's actually being mentored by this adult, right? What's also neat is his changing relationship with his other peer group. Because let's face it, if you walk into a public building and someone is mopping, you have to be one mean little effer if you're going to walk across that wet floor, right? You tend to defer. So suddenly this kid who always was being jostled in the playground, jostled in the hallway, picked on, everything else, he's holding a mop, he's mopping the floor, the kids do this around him. He literally parts them with his mop. Now my point is that what you see there is a pattern where this kid was getting a very powerful identity, a sense of efficacy or control through that relationship, not with his parent, who is a very stressed individual with addiction problems and poverty and a lot of other stuff going on. The janitor had set some structure, some consequences. The child had a sense of belonging, number 7, in this world that had become his space finally. He had, in a sense, a purpose to go to school again. I'm going to argue he even had a bit of social justice. Finally, people were treating him, the one who was mildly, quote-unquote, in his mind, disfigured, awkward-looking, the one who dressed poorly. Suddenly, he was being treated fairly, and what's more, he felt safe.
Wow. I love this story. In a lot of ways, this boy is me. While my teeth are fine, I can relate to some of the decisions he made to seek something better for himself. Unger is making the case that all these physical circumstances around this kid changed. And that is what helped him to build some resilience to get through his school day. Let's keep in mind that Unger is an academic, and he's demonstrating with a story the things his research has shown. That it's the physical or external things around us that help build resilience. I think we can all agree this makes a lot of sense, right? If the negative circumstances around me change and become more positive, that is likely going to improve my outlook on life. If my mom had suddenly won the lottery right after she got divorced, it would have solved a lot of problems for her and made it much easier for her to be resilient through this hard time in her life. But let's ask some deeper questions. Why did this kid go talk to the janitor? What about this kid, or the janitor for that matter, made this janitor even give him attention and let him hang out? What made the kid think, I don't like going to lunch anymore, and I'm going to be brave enough to try and find a different option? I mentioned I can relate to this kid. Those things came from inside himself, right? He had his own hopeful optimism that there is probably a better way to do lunch than to get beat up and picked on by other kids the whole time. He also was pretty resourceful. He used that mop to create some space for himself. Are you standing in the middle of this board between the milk crates with me yet? On one solid milk crate, we have an argument that says, be hopeful and optimistic to get through the hard things in front of you. It's a good argument. We all need more of those things, right? On the other end, the opposite milk crate, we have an argument that says, this has nothing to do with hope and optimism, and we should not individualize resilience in this way. Instead, it is all about changing the physical circumstances around someone that allows them to actually improve their life and build some resilience. Now, there's a whole different podcast on race and poverty here as well that we aren't going to get into, but, you know, something for our community to consider in the future. But for us, right now, how can we stand on this wobbly board in the middle of these two arguments together? I'm guessing some of us are going through hard things right now. Maybe you've experienced some trauma in your life, and it makes getting through your days really hard. Maybe, let's just say for the sake of argument here, there's a pandemic that is making you feel lonely, isolated, overwhelmed. Maybe you have fear for your or a loved one's health. Maybe there's some serious pressure on your income right now. Or maybe you've lost your job altogether, like so many in our economy have. Should you be optimistic? Yes. Should you be resourceful? Yeah. Should you try to forget the memories that hold you hostage and make it difficult to get through your days? Yes. Should you try to change your physical circumstances so that you don't have to experience the thing currently requiring you to be resilient in the first place? Yeah. This is going to look different for all of us. In a lot of ways, my starting this new company is my way to get to the other side of this crazy time. I hope you can all find your own less crazy or maybe more crazy way to do this. But most of all, give yourself a break. Show yourself some compassion. Maybe it's the same compassion you would show a friend that would come to you with some of the stuff you are currently experiencing. I hope we can all find it in ourselves to use some of that same compassion we use with others on ourselves. I want to end with a challenge for everyone. I don't know where you actually stand right now amidst all the chaos, but every one of us could use more resilience. So I ask, what are you going to do to build resilience in yourself and the people around you? My challenge for you is in three parts. First, how are you going to face the day with hopefulness, but not the hollow kind? Second, think of one memory that is helpful and hold on to it. And then think of one that is not so helpful and let it go. Lastly, think of one practical thing you could do that would help improve your own physical circumstances or that of the amazing people around you. Let's go build some resilience.
It's worth keeping this conversation going. Share this podcast with a friend, and you can find resources for discussions and other notes about this episode at our website, fabricmpls.com. You can also go to our contact page or reach out to us on social media to share your feedback and experiences, because Fabric isn't an organization sharing novel ideas. It's a community of people becoming more deeply woven. Thanks for being part of it.